tuned in to the Community Cats Podcast. Ready? Let's go. Welcome to the Community Cats Podcast. I'm Kristen, the technical tabby here at the podcast, stepping in for our regular and spectacular host, Stacey LeBaron. Stacey will be back next week, but I wanted to check in to let you know that this is part two of a special audio version of Return to Field, Saving the Lives of Community Cats, which is a webinar presented earlier this year by our friends at Neighborhood Cats. If you haven't listened to part one, you can go ahead and just hop back to last week's episode and give that a listen so you're not missing out. In this episode, Brian Cordes, who's the National Programs Director at Neighborhood Cats, along with his wife, Susie Richmond, who is the Executive Director, come to you with years of experience managing community cat programs to offer valuable insights into the return to home approach. They'll discuss the benefits, challenges, and profound impacts RTF programs have had on communities across the U.S., from reducing shelter euthanasia rates to freeing up shelter resources. Whether you're looking to implement RTF in your area or you just want to learn more, you won't want to miss out on this really eye-opening conversation. Like I said before, this is an audio presentation of a webinar, so occasionally you may hear mention of visuals. We try to remove those references, but if the content didn't make sense without them, we had to leave them in. But what that means is you can go over to see the whole presentation with all of the beautiful videos and pictures that Brian and Susie shared on our YouTube channel. If you go to youtube.com/@communitycatspodcast, and that's the little at symbol that they've added there, that's where we have it posted along with a ton of other useful videos. So it's totally worth it. Go check that out. So as Stacey always says, thank you for turning your passion for cats into action here with us at the Community Cats Podcast. Thank you for joining us this week, and I hope you learned something new from the show.
All right. So moving on with our presentation, we're going to talk about the mechanics of doing this. And in terms of the flow, this is the way we recommend it goes. So you have intake, and that's your opportunity to gather as much information about the cat and the cat circumstances as you can. You also want to be talking about, potentially, you might decide not to, but you might want to talk about return to field with the finders. And that's the term that's used for the people who bring the cat to the shelter. They're typically called finders. Then once you have the cat within the shelter, you're assessing eligibility, whether they're suitable for the return to field program. If they are, you need to house them, you have the surgery, and then of course you have the return, and then you may have actions you want to take post-return. So we're going to go through each of these steps. So intake is really a crucial point. And if you get the return to field handbook, and again, you can download a copy for free. There are forms that you have people at admissions follow, you know, lists of questions that they ask that can be done very quickly, can be done just in a couple of minutes, but it gets you a lot of really crucial information. And of course, where the cat was trapped, what we call the location of origin, is really critical. And there are some common mistakes. It's where the cat was trapped may not be exactly what the finder's home address was. So you want to clarify that. If you're having trouble pinpointing where the cat was trapped, you can always ring up Google Maps and work with the finder to identify as close as you can the exact location. Also, you want to find out as much as you can about the cat's history. Were they a recent arrival in the neighborhood? Have they been there for a long time? Did they bring the cat in because he was sick? Or what was the cat's behavior? So, for example, why that's really important. So, sometimes, let's say the cat ends up being friendly, and you don't know whether to, you know, you're trying to make a decision about whether to return him back or not. Well, having a little bit of the history of the cat's behavior can be the pivotal factor. So, we've had cases where people have reported a cat came onto their porch that they'd never seen before. They put out a little bit of food, and then the cat never left for a week, did not leave the porch, or did not move from under a car, or whatever it is. So that's a cat whose behavior is showing they're not very familiar with the territory, and they've found what they feel is a safe place, possibly with a little bit of food, and they're not going to leave unless they're forced to. So that would point more towards a cat that had been abandoned, as opposed to a cat who popped up on the porch, had a bite to eat, and then went on his way, who had been seen in the neighborhood months before. That would be, you'd probably be a lot more comfortable about putting that cat back in the territory. So the more you can find out about history, the better. Are there other cats in the area? What are the cat circumstances? Is there a known feeder? Is there construction nearby? Is the finder's reason for bringing the cat in? Again, that's where I was saying you'll find a whole host of motivations. Sometimes it's because they keep having kittens and they don't know what to do anymore. And when you explain, when you talk about spay neuter, that may solve the problem. Sometimes they just don't like cats. Sometimes they don't want the cat in their yard and you have an opportunity to talk about deterrence. So important to ask that. Also make a note of what's the finder's attitude? Are they hostile, indifferent, friendly? Because that may inform whether you do the return and if you do, how you do it. So go to get that return to field handbook and look at the sample forms in the back for intake and then adapt them for your purposes rather than start from scratch would be my recommendation. So when you're talking return to field with finders, well, the first decision is, well, are you going to talk about it or not? I know in Jacksonville, that very first RTF program, they started off talking to finders about the idea of bringing the cats back to, you know, where they were trapped. And in general, it didn't go well. They ended up having a lot of arguments with people, and they ultimately decided, we're just going to do it. We're not going to try to talk about it. The cat's being surrendered to us. We'll determine the outcome. And instead, what they did is they slipped it into their surrender form as one of the possibilities of what might happen once the cat was surrendered. So that's one way to go. I think that in many communities, so this was back in 2008, and now here we are 16 years later, there's a lot more tolerance and understanding of these programs, not everywhere and not everyone, but more. And if you don't talk to your finders about the possibility of the cat coming back, you may be missing opportunities. So like I said, somebody may really love the cat, but they can't handle any more kittens and they don't know that there are spay neuter services available. And once they do, they may come and pick up the cat themselves and save you the trouble of having to return the cat yourself. And again, you can identify problems. You may be able to mitigate their complaints with deterrence, like a lot of return to field programs keep a stock of motion-activated sprinklers, for example, because those are good ways to keep cats out of yards, and they'll lend them to people. And usually after a month or two, the cats learn not to step into the yard. So that conversation can be very fruitful, but it's a shelter-by-shelter decision, and you can always try one thing, and then if it doesn't work, try another. One of the first questions you have to determine when you're talking about, well, which cats are eligible is who's going to make that decision. So who's going to decide whether the cat's eligible? Some shelters do it at admissions. So the person doing intake is the one that gathers the information and then decides on the future pathway for the cat. We found that a better way to do it is for admissions to gather the information, but then for somebody who's experienced and knows more about community cats. For example, a community cat coordinator, if there's one on staff, it's much better for them to at least review the information and any decisions that might have been made, because sometimes somebody with experience is going to just pick up on things that somebody at admissions who may be brand new to the animal welfare world might miss. So, but you could do one of the two. You could take a team approach where you get input from various departments, veterinary, intake, community cat, but that can be very time demanding in terms of if you're in a high volume intake municipal shelter, you're probably not going to be able to take the time to have team meetings over every cat. I think it's great if you can. Again, the more things that are considered, the better, but probably most shelters are going to go with like either admissions or the equivalent of the community cat coordinator making that call. So then we get into eligibility itself. And there's a number of things to consider. The first thing I want to emphasize, though, is that all this should be considered holistically. And one factor may be weak, but another factor strong. And you have to look at the overall picture in order to make the best decision. So when you're looking at the cat herself, obviously the first thing, is there any indicia of ownership? Because if there's a microchip or a collar or something like that, that's going to change the equation. And probably that cat's going to need to be held and an opportunity, an effort made to locate the original owner. If that turns out not to be fruitful, then the cat can come back and be considered again for return to field. Now, the health of the cat is a tricky one, because in your ideal return to field candidate is coming in good, excellent body condition, good weight, bright eyes, no obvious signs of illness of any kind. And that tells you that, hey, that, you know, that cat was doing fine wherever they were. So sometimes people say, like, I live in Minnesota and it's the middle of the winter, and how could I return a cat in these conditions back outside? And my question is always, well, how was the cat doing when the cat came in? And if they're perfectly fine and you can reliably say they came from an outdoor setting, well, they figured it out. They'll be fine. Now, on the other hand, if the cat comes in and the cat's underweight and the coat is dull and the eyes are drippy, that's not a good candidate for return to field. That's not a cat that was thriving outdoors. And the risks to the cat, if you return them, are, I'm not saying rule it out, but the risks are higher, obviously. Now, you can't universally say, okay, unhealthy cats don't go back and healthy cats do, because sometimes the health issues are such that once they're overcome, the cat will do fine. So if a cat comes in and they have an abscess on their paw, and that's the reason they can't go back right away, well, maybe once the abscess has been treated, then they may be a very good return to field candidate. So are they healthy? And if they're not, why, has a lot to do with it. Disability, is the cat have three legs? Are they, you know, missing an eye? Something like that. Again, it's very few of these things are black or white. Like, you should say, all right, we're never going to release a declawed cat, or we're never going to release a cat with three legs, because it all depends on their circumstances, right? If somebody has been identified as taking care of them and they're coming from a cul-de-sac and they don't move around much and they're fairly safe, then potentially you could put them back despite the disability. So I'm not saying you should, but I'm just saying nothing should be automatic. Age, that goes more towards kittens. If you do this work, you know that you start getting beyond 8 weeks old and the kittens start becoming more and more difficult to socialize. And if you're in a lot of communities, the resources available to socialize feral kittens are not very many and probably taken up already. So you may have like an 8 or 9 week old kitten who's feral and no other alternative. And so it's probably not a good idea, again, to have some bright red line where you say, well, if they're under 4 months, they're not going back up. You can do with that 9 week old feral kitten who might have done perfectly fine if he had gone back into his territory. On the other hand, I do want to say with age, you have to consider what it may look like to the public and be careful about that. So I've seen programs get into trouble where the van pulls up, hand reaches out, drops a 6 week old kitten on the sidewalk and drives away and leaves the kitten there crying. Somebody comes along, takes a video of it, and boom, your program is in trouble. Don't do that. If they're little baby kittens who are just going to, they have to be released very close to where they were trapped, like almost the exact same spot. And if you don't know that or you can't do that, be careful about protecting your program. And that's where you do make the effort to, and at 6 weeks, they should be able to be socialized. So again, we talked about the history, what was their behavior at the time they were found, and of course, their temperament. If the cat is really feral or acting very feral, or doing poorly in a shelter situation, if you can take some time, you know, just about every cat, whether they're friendly or not, has the potential to act feral upon being trapped because they're freaked out, right? and they're in a strange environment, and it may take them at least a few days before they'll calm down and show their true nature. But there are also cats who are friendly and just hate being in a shelter environment and will never act adoptable when they're in that setting. So if you're not sure and you have capacity to take cats in and you think that might be a good outcome, but you're not sure if the cat's feral or not, then you might want to wait a bit. But if you're pretty sure, if you don't have that luxury and the cat is acting feral and is not a suitable adoption or foster candidate, then a return to field is a great alternative. So temperament's a factor. It can be a deceptive one. And sometimes we'll talk about friendly cats. It really doesn't matter whether they're friendly or not if other things are pointing towards returning the cat. So how about the location of origin? This is information you'll have gathered at intake. Are they about to knock all the buildings on the block down? Is there a history of somebody shooting cats at that location? Most likely the answer is no. You want to know about that. Does the finder, the person who surrenders the cat, or other residents pose a realistic risk of harm? And I emphasize the word realistic because a lot of people, a lot of finders, not all of them, well, I should even say a lot, some, they'll be angry when they find out the cat may be coming back, and they may act threatening or say threatening things. And that's, in most shelter, I think, shelters experience, that's not, that's just bluster. Somebody who's really going to cause harm is not going to be talking about it. But on the other hand, if there's a history of problems with that particular person, or they start, potentially you're afraid they're going to get violent at the intake desk, you might want to consider that. But it's not very many people out there who are going to actually be, commit acts of cruelty towards animals. So don't be too much on a knife's edge about that. But do assess if it's a real, if there's a history of harm and things like that. Are there caretakers or others who are waiting for the cat? Are there feeders who want the cat back? Is there any vulnerable protected wildlife in the area? So some ground nesting birds who are rare, that, maybe not a great place to be, that may be where you try to find a barn placement or something like that. So what about friendly cats and kittens? That's really the most controversial part of this program now. I mean, the program as a whole was certainly controversial when it started and still is in areas where it's being introduced. But among more mature return to field programs, the issue of what to do with friendly cats and kittens is the hot button topic now. And our feeling at Neighborhood Cats is that there's not a clear right or wrong about this. The only thing we think is wrong is if the program is running on autopilot and there are things like policies like they came from outside, so they go back outside. Well, they may have been found outside, but that doesn't mean they came from outside. Somebody might have dumped them. They may have gotten lost, whatever it might be. Or something like, all cats over 4 months old go back and none of the cats under do. So this bright red line about age. And as I discussed before, that could be a mistake when it comes to that individual cat. So what you're after is an evaluation to the extent you can, and you may only have a few minutes to do this, but still don't go on autopilot. Try to give each cat an individual assessment and to the best of your ability, determine what the best available outcome is. And you're not always going to be right. It's more comfortable to be on autopilot. Then you don't have to think about it. Then you don't have to worry about, did I make the right decision or not? It's like, the cat's this old, so the cat, this happens. The cat came from outside. They go, it's very easy, but it's not necessarily the best thing for the animals. So when you're evaluating what to do with social friendly cats and kittens, say, who can be very easily handled, one of the things you want to consider is, what is the shelter's capacity for care? So if the shelter is full, it doesn't really matter how friendly the cat is, right? There's no room for them. It's not going to be a healthy environment. And keeping the cat out of the shelter is priority number one. And if he's got a home, he's going to find it a lot faster on his own than for you to go find a foster or to try to find him a home. So in that idea. You know, what is the average length of stay if the cat's going to, you know, potentially be in the shelter for weeks or months and it's crowded? That's not a good thing. And that may weigh in favor of putting the cat back. What's the cat's history? I mentioned that before. We had a cat, a very friendly cat, who was brought in, and the rest of the neighbors were up in arms. This had been a cat who'd been part of the community, an outdoor cat, for years, and they wanted their cat back. So certainly that was an easy decision to make. In the end, when it comes to eligibility, each cat deserves his own evaluation and consideration of the circumstances to the extent that you're able to gather that information. So what you've decided the cat is eligible, where you're going to house them, we recommend you keep the RTF cats separate from the general cat population and away from, and if it's possible, to keep them away from barking dogs, and do that as well. What you're seeing in the slide here is the what we call the TNR VIA at the Maui Humane Society. And this is a room that's used to be an overnight drop-off kennel and got converted to a much better use. And this is the community cat room. And you can see how the cats are kept in traps, not in cages. So they're only going to be there for a short, you know, a couple of days. So they're perfectly fine in the traps. And you can see how the traps are up on tables. That makes it easier to feed and to clean. And it's quiet and it's separate. So any space that's what we call warm, dry, and secure. Warm so that when they come out of spay-neuter surgery and maybe not be able to fully regulate their body temperature, it's at least 65 degrees in the environment, protected from the weather. And people who are not involved with the program do not have, or animals who are not part of the program do not have access to the space. When you're thinking about where to house them, if you have choices, try to make it convenient in terms of them coming in and then going off to be fixed. So if there's an on-campus clinic, you don't want to keep the cats in a room where you have to then walk across campus and climb three flights of stairs to get to the clinic. You want something much closer. And same thing with pickup drop-off. If you're using an outside clinic, think about the ease of that if you have choices. In terms of the equipment, I mentioned that traps on tables. Some shelters prefer to use feral cat dens inside cages, which if that equipment is available to you is perfectly fine. If you don't know what a feral cat den is, it's that white box looking thing that the cat is inside of, and you can see how there's a porthole door to the right of the that's lifted up. So you can put the den inside the cage with the porthole door shut so the cat can't get out. And then when the den is inside the cage, you can use a ruler or a broomstick and you can lift the porthole door up through the bars of the cages. So there's never any chance of injury or escape. A much more extensive and expensive setup, but that is what some shelters prefer. Either way, it is going to be fine. Certainly if the cat's going to be there for an extended stay, then you might want to use cages if they're available to you. Although we have held cats in traps. I mean, we don't like to do it for more than, say, 4 or 5 days, but sometimes we've had to medicate a cat for like a week or two, and they get bored, but they're fine. It doesn't pose a threat to their health to be in a trap as long as it's covered and it's quiet. So one of the considerations, of course, then, is the length of the stray hold. If you're in a jurisdiction with a 10-day stray hold, well, that's going to put a cramp in your return to field program, and you're going to need this more extensive housing to hold the cats. If you are, you know, facing that, Arizona came up with a great workaround, which is they passed a law. They passed a state law that if the cat is part of a return to field program, the stray hold is waived. So that's the ideal circumstances that you'd be working in, is there's no stray hold at all, and the cat can go back as soon as possible. So this statute can serve as a model if you're trying to get a similar law or similar rule in your jurisdiction. It doesn't always have to be on the state level. You might be able to do it on the municipal level. Caring for cats in traps is not very hard if you know what you're doing and you have the right equipment. you need traps that are at least 30 inches in length and have a sliding rear door so that you can access both ends of the trap. And then you need equipment that's called trap dividers. And that's those pitchfork looking things. And this demonstrates the method. The cat is on one end of the trap. You pull back the sheet, and feral cats especially, they tend to move from light to dark. So they'll follow the sheet towards the other end away from you. You insert the dividers, and that sections the cat off. You can then open that end of the trap that they're not on and put fresh newspaper in, which they tend to use as litter. You can put food and water in. And if you do this twice a day, the traps stay reasonably clean and they're perfectly fine. There is a video on our website, the Neighborhood Cats website. You can click on the Caring for Cats and Traps page, and you'll find about a 5-minute video that demonstrates each step of doing this. It's a pretty simple technique, but very effective. Another thing you have to think about is tracking the cat as he moves through the shelter and to the spay-neuter clinic. So this is an example of a form that created by the Maui Humane Society that they use to track the cat. Very important that there be a photo, and it's really best that it be color, because if you've got black and white photos of calico cats, for example, you could mix them up pretty easily. And so having a color photo makes misidentification less likely. And then there's all the information you can see on the form that's filled in as the cat moves through the system. This form is attached to the trap itself. In the case of this shelter, they keep the form in a plastic sleeve that's zip tied to the front of the trap. When you get to surgery, the important thing, or I should say one of the most important things when it comes to return to field programs, is that you want to cycle the cats through your return to field program as quickly as possible, so that the less time they spend in the shelter, the healthier for the shelter, the healthier for the cat. And so your ideal situation is the cat comes in on Monday. The cat is fixed either a Monday afternoon or probably more likely Tuesday morning when the surgeries are being done, is held overnight. There's no medical issues apparent, and the cat is released on Wednesday. So comes in on Monday, is back home on Wednesday. That's your ideal cycle. Your standard veterinary treatment is going to be spay-neuter, ear tip for identification, and a rabies vaccine where it's legally required. There is obviously other medical treatments that can be done if they're needed, but they tend to be as time and resources allow. So if you can, you know, clean their ears or pull a tooth or whatever it might be, that's great. It might be the only time this cat ever sees a veterinarian. But on the other hand, if you're dealing with a large volume of cats and scarce resources, as most shelters are, you know, those may not be options that are available for you, and you may need to stick to the basic, but maybe just flag the more severe cases so other shelter staff can decide what to do.
Embrace your cat addiction with Whisker Tracker. Download the free mobile app that lets you track your cat sightings and helps you manage your cat colonies. You can create cat profiles, see your cats on a map, and track the health and status of all your cats. Whisker Tracker is available to download now, with new features being added monthly. Cat facial recognition will allow you to identify cats and help find missing pets. You can track your walks and how many cats you spotted, complete fun cat finding challenges, and climb to the top of the kitty leaderboard. The cats' locations are private for their safety, but you can connect with other caretakers through the cat's profile. When you sign up for a premium subscription using a rescue's referral code, the rescue will get a portion of the monthly revenue. Help support your favorite rescue by taking pictures of cats. With badges, leaderboards, and a community of cat lovers, Whisker Tracker is more than just an app. It's a movement. Get it? It's a movement. Join the cat spotting community and download the Whisker Tracker mobile app today. Tomahawk Live Trap exceeds customers' expectations by providing them with the highest quality humane animal control products available. Check out their new Pro Series Gravity Door Trap. They feature a door that sets automatically when you open it. No hook or plate setting needed. Use discount code KEEPITHUMANE for 10% off your order at livetrap.com. In a recent study, 97% of respondents said that pets are family. Communities can play a vital role in helping to keep families together. Whether it's reuniting lost pets with their owners, donating pet supplies or funds for pet owners in need, or offering short or long-term fostering, people can help keep pets and their people together. We just have to show them how. Did you know there are resources you can use to help bring attention to the programs you offer to help them do just that? From public service announcements, short videos, printable posters, online and social graphics, and much more. Find your resources at www.petsandpeopletogether.org/campaign-resources. Hashtag be a helper.
Recovery time is typically overnight. Now, that has a lot to do with the experience level of your surgeon. If you have an experienced spay-neuter surgeon and they're making very small incisions on the female cats, then overnight should be plenty, and certainly for the male cats. If you're dealing with a less experienced surgeon who's making a larger incision, then you may want to extend the recovery time to more like 48 hours. But most surgeons in doing this kind of work are very good at making small incisions that heal quickly. And typically, these cats do not need to be held for more than overnight. So then you get to the return, and the question becomes, who does it? So you have, here are your options. You can have shelter staff with a dedicated vehicle. You could have your animal control officers if they're affiliated with the shelter. You could have volunteers, or you could have a partner group. So in the beginning of the RTF program in Maui, Neighborhood Cats was the partner group, and we picked up the cats from the shelter and we brought them home. Since then, the staff at Maui Humane Society has taken that over, and they have their own, like I say, dedicated vehicle, and we're not, Susie and I are not doing that anymore. Sometimes shelters find that for legal reasons, it's better to have, like they may be wondering, well, is it legal for us to, you know, given the unique laws of the jurisdiction, they're not sure whether they would get into trouble if they're the group that does the actual release. So they do a transfer to a partner group, and then the partner group does the actual release, because they're not beholden to the same regulations that the shelter may be. All sorts of ways to do that. If you're the actual person who's picking up the cat from the shelter and going to be opening the door and letting the cat go, these are the things you want to do before you put the cat in your car. So we always had vet techs check the cats at the very last minute just to make sure there was nothing that, you know, nothing that wasn't going properly with the healing, or the cat had suddenly gotten URI or something like that. You want to, like a lot of shelters, even with the RTF cats, and or with some of them, they may end up with collars on them or some type of identification that's typical for the shelter. And so, for example, maybe at first it was thought this cat might be an adoption candidate, so they got moved into the adoption section and got a collar put on them. And then it was determined, no, actually, this isn't going to work out. And the cat got put back into the return to field process, but nobody took the collar off. Well, I can tell you from one very bad experience, you don't want to find out the cat has a collar as you're watching him run off into the distance. So that's on the checklist. Make sure that all identification has been removed. If your shelter is leaning towards not releasing friendly cats, then you want to recheck their behavior, because by the time you're ready to do the release, they may have calmed down. Verify before you go out into the field that you're returning the cat to a valid address. And what we would do, we would ring up the address on Google Maps, make sure it existed. If you see the pin go into the middle of an intersection, it means the address doesn't exist. Also, most of the time, of course, it does. But you can then use Google Maps to zoom in and actually scout the area that you'll be returning the cat to and make decisions about where the best spot would be. And then finally, make sure the trap or the den, if you're using those, make sure it's locked and secure. When you're doing the return, there's a number of things to consider. How discreet do you want to be? Now, that, again, that's a program-by-program decision. There's not a right or a wrong. And it also may depend on what stage your program is at. I think when we first started, there was a lot of concern about how are people going to react to this. We tended to be much more discreet, out of sight, out of mind. But as the program has evolved, well, now a well-wrapped van pulls up and the cats come jumping out. So it's become much more visible and more of an opportunity to connect with the community and give information. What's the weather going to be like? Do you want to, you know, wait until it's not raining? Do you release that in the day or at night? So if we're releasing cats into a heavily trafficked industrial area, we'll wait until dark when it's quiet. How close to the location? So as close as you safely can. If you, again, this goes back to the information that was gathered at intake. If the notes are, hey, the finder was really angry and really hostile, well, you probably don't want to drop the cat off right in front of his front door. Maybe go to the other side of the block. The older the cat is, the more distance you can go. It's only if you're dealing with very young cats, kittens, that you need to be as close as possible to the trapping location. But an adult cat, their territory is going to extend at least a block or two or more from the trapping location. If there was a caretaker involved, has that caretaker been contacted? Do they want to be present? If you can locate the caretaker, sometimes you can return little kittens. We've seen moms with their litters returned because there was somebody there. It was known somebody was there to take care of them. So other things to consider is the release location on public property or private. So you got to be careful about going out to private property. You don't want to be trespassing, and you may need to find the closest public location. Becomes a question of judgment when you're in this sort of quasi-public, like say a parking lot of a shopping center or of a condominium complex, then you need your return people to use good judgment. We talked about the kittens. Now, dealing with confrontation. So it's going to be rare, but once in a while, somebody's going to see you and is going to be upset about it. We recommend having material on you that lists the program's contact information and maybe a small brochure that explains what. And it's fine to try to have a conversation. If you are finding that the person is not listening to you and is just staying angry, then you need to just go. You need to hand them the flyer. If you'll take it, get in your van. And if the cat hasn't been released yet, you think it might not be safe, then to bring the cat back with you and reconsider the situation. You might keep the cat. You might let the cat go at another spot where you're not going to have that confrontation. But the one thing you don't want to do is get into an argument and a back and forth, because that just escalates things. And it's also a good idea for the people who are doing the returns, if they're doing them alone, somebody at the shelter should know they're out on their rounds and be available if they do need help. Now, never had that happen. We had to make that call ourselves, and we returned, Susie and I, over 1,000 cats. But it's good to know you're not going to get put on hold if you're in an emergency. Have an emergency number. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time going quickly through the idea of how can you combine return to field and trap neuter return, not only to drive down euthanasia with return to field, but also potentially reduce the cat population in the community. So you're having to do less and less return to field over time, and it makes it more sustainable. And we often call this the red flag approach. People in the field have had different experiences, but I've done TNR in multiple communities around the country. And my experience is that these cats tend to live in groups. So if somebody brings in one cat and surrenders them to the shelter, to me, that means there's probably other cats at that location. So that RTF cat becomes the red flag where there's cats at that area. So if you have 10 cats in a backyard colony and just the one cat is surrendered, because again, remember, this kind of trapping tends to be very inefficient. The person may only have one trap. They may not know how to do this in a way that is effective for all the cats, may only do it once, whatever it might be. That cat is brought, he's returned to field, and now you've got 1 out of 10 cats who's been spayed or neutered and 9 cats who are not. Okay, so that's not going to make any difference in the long term over the number of cats, because the loss of reproductive capacity in that one cat is more than compensated for by the 9 cats who can still reproduce. So the limit on the number of cats is just going to be the carrying capacity, how much food is available. If you look at return to field alone from a community viewpoint, and you're just doing RTFs of individual cats, you may get a couple from one group here and one from a group there, but none of these colonies of cats or groups or neighborhoods or however unit you want to use, the sterilization levels are not going to be high enough for the number of cats to go down over time. You have to have a high sterilization rate in order for attrition and removal of cats for adoption or things like that, for that to outpace new cats being born. You need to have a high sterilization rate. And with return to field, that's not the purpose of the program. So that's generally not achieved. So basically, it's neutral when it comes to population control. But what if we used this cat as a red flag, and then we went into that neighborhood and TNR'd all the rest of the other 9 cats? Now we have 10 out of 10 who are sterilized, and our opportunity for the numbers to go down over time has greatly increased. It's what we call colony level targeting, where we're trying to get high sterilization rates within all the RTF cats groups. Now, you can do it another way, which is what we call community level targeting, where you don't use the RTF cat as a red flag unless they're in your target area. So in this case, zip code 3 is where we have the most cats in the community and the most complaints and the most intake. So we're going to go in and we're going to TNR any cats we can in zip code 3. We're going to put our resources there, use the RTF cats as red flags, but also look for other cats in zip code 3. And in the other zip codes, we're just going to do RTF. We're not going to worry about population control there because it's not as important as population control in zip code 3, which is the most problematic. So that's another way to combine targeting with return to field. This combination of targeting and return to field was part of what was called the Community Cat Program that was led by Best Friends Animal Society in 6 cities. And it was very successful. That feline euthanasia went down on average by 83%, but at the same time, intake went down by 32%. So not only were they getting more cats out alive, they were having fewer cats coming in. So the combination of those two methods is very powerful. And this is a close-up look at one of those cities, Albuquerque, and it just tells the chart tells the tales. So again, interested in both euthanasia and intake, and the green is the number of return to field cats, and didn't have that number for 2015 and 16. Basically, 2010 was before anything happened, so a little less than 10,000 cats coming in, and a little over half of them were being euthanized. Then in 2009, the shelter on its own started a return to field program. And you can see how from 2010 to 2011, you see the green. So those were the number of cats returned to field. And so once again, we see euthanasia go down by a corresponding amount. But look at intake compared to 2011 to 2010. It actually went up a little bit. So the return to field program had a dramatic impact on euthanasia and none on intake. Then in 2012, the return to field program was complemented by a targeted TNR program. So you see euthanasia continuing to drop as the return to field continued. But now, because there's population control happening with the targeting, intake starts to go down. And it keeps going down throughout the ensuing years. So as euthanasia is dropping, so is intake. So that's your ideal program, which is you want to work yourself out of a job. You want to get return to field numbers down to a minimum. And the way to do that is to cut off the flow of cats coming in. If you're interested in targeting and learning more about it, there's a free webinar. The recording is available on the Community Cats Podcast website, and it's goes over targeting and how to do it in great detail. If you're not certified, our TNR certification workshop, we just go over all the nuts and bolts of TNR on a ground level. So we have time for some questions, Kristen, if you'd like.
Always love questions, Brian. We get to pick your brain. It's great. So somebody in the chat had mentioned that they knew there was abuse or killing of cats going on at one particular house on a block. They're trying to TNR. They had the police come out. They didn't find evidence. So now they have baby kittens there. How do you handle it when, in the rare case, when there is actually abuse, somebody follows through on that, I hate the cats and I want them gone?
Yeah, well, that's when you have to seek alternate placements. And you may have that really tough decision about, is euthanasia kinder than putting a cat back in a situation that they're going to be abused? But, you know, that's where it takes that extra yard to get a live outcome, to find a relocation or to find a sanctuary or to bring in partners from even other parts of the country to place kittens and cats and things like that. But yeah, I would not be comfortable putting a cat back into a known cruelty situation.
Barn cat programs, if you're not familiar.
Cat programs too, becoming more and more popular, where breweries and businesses that typically have rodent problems are basically adopting cats to keep on the premises. So that's another program. It's actually gaining in popularity.
Yes, I have a whole collection of stickers from breweries that have cats. It's a managed relocation, so I feel like that's a little bit easier than trying to relocate a whole colony. Talk a little bit about relocating. So you've got a situation where you can't put the cats back. There is always the question, why can't we just release them in the field next to the school or whatever? Like, they think that it's a good place for cats to be. Why is that not a great idea? And when you do relocate, do you recommend a particular process or do you not recommend it at all? What is your preference?
There are types of wildlife that are called cold release animals. And they're animals that you can take from one environment and place in a similar environment somewhere else, and they'll be perfectly fine. That's not cats. Cats are very tied to their territory and to their food source. And if you release them somewhere else without a proper relocation process, they're going to immediately run away and try to find their old haunting grounds. So what you have to do is you have to confine them in the new territory for ideally 2 to 3 weeks, and teach them that their food source has changed. So on Maui, after the fire, you know, destroyed all of the town of Lahaina, we had like hundreds of community cats on our hands. And one of the ways that we relocated them is we bought large outdoor enclosures. So they have little huts they can hang out in and a 6-foot outdoor area, and we set those up for people, and then they would keep the cats in there for 3 weeks and then open the door and let them out. And by then they were acclimated to their new neighborhood. So you have to go through that type of process.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. We are at time. Brian, do you want to take one more question?
Sure.
Okay. Yes. Excellent. I have one good one here. What do you do if you're returning cats and they don't have a feeder or there's not a colony manager hanging around, keeping an eye on them? Like, are there concerns that you have? How do you mitigate those concerns? Do you assign a caretaker? What is your process for doing that?
So it's one of the things I mentioned in the very beginning, which is usually with a return to field cat, you have not identified the caretaker and you don't know who the feeder is and you don't know who the caretaker is. And the reason you're putting the cat back without knowing that is if the cat came in good condition, then you can assume that somebody is taking care of the cat, right? It might be a bunch of neighbors. It might be an individual caretaker. So identifying who the actual feeder is usually not part of the return to field process. The only time you would really want to do that is if you had special cases, like maybe a disabled cat or very young kittens, where you wouldn't be comfortable just leaving them. And so you can't make the assumption that they'd be okay. But when a cat comes in good body weight, healthy, somebody is taking care of that cat, even if you don't know who.
Yeah, they were doing fine before you got there. They will do fine afterwards. Excellent. We really appreciate that you guys are here. Join us again for either a TNR workshop or that colony caretaking tips and tricks or any of the new ones next year. We're going to be announcing those dates shortly. So thank you again to Brian and Susie for all of your expertise and sharing this presentation. And we'll see you guys at the TNR workshop.
That's it for this week. Please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review. We love to hear what you think, and a 5-star review really helps others find the show. You can also join the conversation with listeners, cat caretakers, and me on Facebook and Instagram. And don't forget to hit follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single show. Thanks for listening, and thank you for everything that you do to help create a safe and healthy world for cats.